Mitchell Warren, and I direct AVAC, and delighted to welcome you to this call on behalf of AVAC and the Global Network of People Living with HIV, GNP+, the International HIV-AIDS Alliance, and Stop AIDS Now. And we're really delighted to welcome all of you onto this call and hopefully onto the website so you can see the slides to have initially a presentation about the very recently released WHO Consolidated Guidelines, and then have a chance to have a couple of additional perspectives to those guidelines, and then really open it up for questions and conversation amongst the group. This call is being recorded, so if you missed parts of the call, it will be available on the website later today, and you certainly are welcome to share it with colleagues after that as well, to ensure that people get a sense of where the field is now and where it is going. We're really delighted to welcome a number of partners, advocates, policymakers to this call. The format for the call is we're going to have a couple of brief presentations, and we will then take questions and any observations and comments. At any point during the email, during the webinar, you are welcome to email questions to avac@avac.org. Or if you're on the website watching the slides, you can at any point enter questions into the chat feature, and we will see those queued up and be sure those get asked. And also, right now the line is on global mute to keep the line clear, but we will welcome questions from people on the line. At that point, you'll be welcome to hit *7 to unmute your line and *6 to mute again after you ask your question. And I'll go through those instructions again as we go, but want to make sure that people, as you think of questions, feel free to send them in here. The structure of the call, we're very excited about, is we're going to start with the presentation from Gottfried Hernschel from the World Health Organization, who leads the HIV-AIDS department there, is going to provide an overview of the consolidated guidelines. We're then going to welcome Munu from GNP+ to provide both a perspective on the guidelines, but also a really exciting update about a community guide that's in development related to the guidelines. We'll then get a brief perspective from the field from Dr. Thobile Mbangashe, the Chief Director for HIV at the South African Department of Health. And South Africa and the Department of Health there have been deeply engaged in the guideline development process that Gottfried will describe. We'll get a perspective on the ground there, and then we'll open it up for questions. So that's the kind of run of the show for today. We're really delighted to welcome so many people to the line and really want to thank Gottfried and his team at the HIV department for participating in today's call and really for the enormous amount of work that has gone on for well over a year in developing these first-ever consolidated guidelines on the use of antiretrovirals. So with that, again, if you have questions as we go, feel free to send them to email avac@avac.org or put them into the web interface. And with that, I'd love to welcome you, Gottfried, to the call, and we can run your slides from here.
Great. Thank you so much, Mitch. First of all, for organizing this seminar, there's obviously a lot of interest right now, and we're having quite a number of conversations already in countries and also at regional level, and I'm coming to that. I'm here with my colleague, Meg Doherty, who coordinates the treatment team in the department and has been providing the technical oversight to the guideline development process in WHO. So any difficult technical questions you will have, Meg will answer. I will try to stick to time and really just highlight a few issues, so it's not going to be a comprehensive presentation, but I just want to, next slide please, talk a bit about what do we mean by consolidation. The effort really was to make the new guidelines as user-friendly as possible, and to not just, as in previous version, talk about mainly the technical aspects and the clinical recommendations, but really speak about the what to do, so to speak, the clinical part, but also operational aspects, how to do it, but also how to decide and prioritize and set programmatic sort of sequence steps. What is important is also to note that we very much emphasize the continuum of care and see the continuum of care as sort of the organizing principle in the guideline, that we try to combine recommendations for different age groups and populations, and obviously build on already existing recommendations but add some of the new ones. Next slide, please. Just, it's a bit of a crowded slide, but just to sort of demonstrate the structure of the document, as I said, it's along the continuum of care, and you see six chapters that are along that continuum, starting from testing to obviously enrollment in care, then ART initiation, but then also making decisions, first, second, and second and also third line recommendations, and also operational recommendations for the actual service delivery. Next slide, please. So let me start about one area that has probably gotten the most attention when we launched the guidelines, and that is when to start ART. Next slide. And I think probably most people on the call will be aware that the threshold moved to below 500 CD4, and that new recommendation, obviously, there was quite some concern that those who are the sickest still require somewhat priority attention, so that very much built into the recommendation here. There are also for independent situations for ART initiations, in other words, initiation of ART regardless of CD4 cell count, and these are specifically in HIV serodiscordant couples, pregnancy, but also in children less than 5 years of age. We see the guidelines as a tool for countries to produce their own guidelines. So these are global guidelines, and the process of guideline adaptation has already started in many countries where countries start looking at these global recommendations and see what they do or may not mean in the given context. Next slide, please. We want to be quite explicit and upfront about this. There are also certain populations that have no specific recommendation, specifically individuals with HIV who are 50 years of age or older, individuals co-infected with HIV and HCV. WHO is currently working on general HCV guidelines, and we will also update then the consolidated guidelines to address co-infection very shortly, individuals with HIV-2, but also key populations with a high risk of HIV transmission, specifically sex workers and IDUs. So they will be treated, and there was quite some discussion about this and continues to be, but they will be treated like other adults or adolescents. Next, please. You are probably aware of the sort of shift in the PMTCT-related recommendation, where the new guidelines recommend option B and option B plus, basically with the recommendation that all pregnant women infected with HIV should initiate studies and should be maintained at least for the duration of mother-to-child transmission risk. And obviously, many countries have already started to move towards option B plus as a policy decision, and some of the countries also are starting to implement that. Next slide, please. Now, in terms of children, there's another important change, that is that children below 5 years would be recommended for starting regardless of CD4 cell count. And you will see that there's a difference in the strength of the recommendation depending on the age. Below 1 year, it's a strong recommendation, and it's a conditional recommendation between above 1 year and to 5 years. Next slide, please. So this was about when to start. There's also, in terms of what ART regimen to start, there's also some changes. And next slide, please. Specifically, to move towards, in first line, towards greater simplification and the recommendation of one first-line regimen, which is TDF plus 3TC or FTC plus efavirenz. And obviously, this leads to greater simplicity. We know now that this is a regimen that is very effective and well-tolerated as and available as a single once-daily fixed-dose combination, and should therefore be easy to prescribe and also easy to take. It also facilitates harmonization of regimens across a range of populations, now including pregnant women, and children above 3 years, TB and Hep B, hepatitis B. And obviously with the idea of simplifying other aspects, programmatic aspects such as drug procurement, etc., but also safety, efficacy, and affordability. Next slide, please. In terms of how to monitor and when to switch from first to second line regimen, there's also an important new recommendation in the guidelines. Next, please. Basically recommending broader use of viral load. So the recommendation is viral load as the preferred monitoring approach with the idea of diagnosing and confirming ARV treatment failure early as possible. Obviously, it's understood and it's clear that viral load is at this point not routinely available. So in such instances, obviously, CD4 count and clinical monitoring should be used to diagnose treatment failure, but also from a programmatic aspect, countries are very much encouraged to build up their viral load capacity. And with, obviously, the understanding that there's some point of care viral load tests in the pipeline, we feel is a fairly forward-looking recommendation in many contexts, but one where we would like countries to really start moving. Next, please. So the summary of the adult MCH guidelines, again, this is a bit of a crowded slide, but it basically shows the evolution of guidance, the various versions of the guidance between 2002 and 2013. And again, when to start, you see in the yellow column, CD4 below 500. Again, you see the first preferred option of fixed-dose combinations. You see also second line, you see third line. There hasn't been too much change in second and third line. And then you see viral load tested. So this is just really to demonstrate the evolution towards early initiation, simpler treatment, less toxic, more robust regimen, and better and more effective monitoring approaches. Next slide, please. As I said, there is also, beyond the clinical recommendations, there are also operational and service delivery recommendations, and I will not go into much detail here, but just highlight the areas which those focus. Expanded testing scenarios, looking also at community-based testing approaches and a mix of approaches beyond facility-based testing. The notion of task shifting and decentralization, integration of with other services, the notion of adherence support and retention in care. So there are some specific, more detailed recommendations in those areas in the guidelines. Next, please. Just some of the arguments that we have been bringing forward when we were launching the guidelines in terms of what the guidelines mean, what they will cost, but also what they will buy us. Next slide, please. Next. Again, if we compare the 2010 to the 2013 guidelines in terms of numbers of individuals becoming ART eligible, you see that there is an increase from 2010 of 16.7 million people being eligible to close to 26 million, 25.9 million people becoming eligible. So obviously, by lowering the threshold, more people become eligible. And I won't have time to go into the details, but the slide basically shows you that currently, the green part of the bar, it means that 9.7 million are currently already on AOT, and you see the other bars that show you which segment of the population basically would be added there in terms of general adults, kids below 5 years, pregnant women, and several discordant couples. Next slide, please. In terms of estimated impact on incidents and deaths, just to demonstrate that with a full implementation over the next few years, we are expecting an additional impact on HIV infections and a decrease of 36%. And in terms of HIV-related deaths, an additional decrease of 39%. So in absolute numbers, it's 3.5 million additional new infections averted and 3 million additional lives saved. Next, please. This is just a summary slide, again, to show consolidation in which areas. Already talked about it. The key new recommendations, again, clinical as well as operational service delivery and the implications and impact that I just described. Next slide. Next slide, please. So what are the next steps? As Mitch has said, the guidelines were launched a bit more than a month ago at the IES conference in Kuala Lumpur. We have already over the month of July held a number of regional capacity building events where we have invited teams from countries to basically come and discuss the new recommendations and also start discussing specifically what they would mean in their context. We had a workshop in South Africa in July with 13 countries participating. We also had one in Indonesia for several Asian countries, and we have several more planned. I'm not going to go through the full list there, where you see a region like CERO, WIPCO, EMRO, these are WHO regions, and obviously they are for groups of countries. In addition to the more regional events, we also have requests from countries to actually have national workshops. We already had a national discussion in Indonesia, for example, in India. We have a discussion coming up in Rwanda in August. We have a workshop in the Caribbean, etc., etc. And we're also using major conferences, and specifically over the next few months, ICAP and ICASA, to have skills-building events so that countries and whoever is interested can actually engage in discussion around the guidelines and their implications. Obviously, these events provide opportunities to explore country-level acceptability, feasibility, implications in a given context, but also the needed investments for changing eligibility and switching regimen, etc., etc. One thing that is very important, obviously, is that these workshops, and we very strongly emphasize this in all our workshops that we've already been discussing, need to involve not just the government policymakers, but we would really want to have a broad range of stakeholders, and certainly including civil society networks, NGOs, etc., so that affected communities, so that basically there can be different views shared and that a decision can be made based on inputs from these various groups. This has been quite successful, as I said, in these two regional workshops where we had strong civil society participation in Jakarta and also in Sub-Saharan Africa, and we certainly want to continue that also in these national events. I would like to stop here. I've gone maybe 2 minutes over time, but obviously Meg and I stand ready to respond to any questions. I have not discussed the method and the process of development of the guidelines, but I just would like to highlight it's been a very consultative process, a fairly elaborate process, and where we have had also the help of some of the civil society networks, specifically the Alliance and also GMP Plus, helping us with getting the community perspectives in the formulations, to be considered in the formulations of the recommendations. Thank you, Mitch.
Great. Gottfried, thank you. I think you kept the time brilliantly, and I know you were covering an enormous amount of content, and I know lots of great questions have already come in, and we'll get to those in a moment. But really want to thank you and your whole team for the work that's gone on and for the clarity that you presented here this morning. Just to remind people, we are going to open the lines in just a couple of minutes. If you do have questions as we go, avac@avac.org or the chat feature on the website. But before we open it up, as Gottfried said, there have been a number of ways in which civil society and others have engaged in the process. And thought before we open it up for questions, wanted to turn it over to one of the co-sponsors of today's call, GNP Plus, and particularly to Munu Nyambe, who's going to present work that GNP Plus has been leading with the Alliance and Stop AIDS Now on community perspectives and the way forward. So Munu, if you want to hit *7 to unmute, and we will turn to your presentation, and then again, we'll get the conversation going.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, everybody, and good morning for those of you, but it's still morning. As mentioned, my name is Mono Nyambe, and I will be giving community perspectives and responses on the guidelines, as well as highlight and promote the community guide that Mitchell mentioned that's being prepared at the moment in response to these guidelines. I will touch on three aspects. Firstly, next slide, please. Firstly, the way in which community voices have informed these guidelines, and then how the community has responded to finished products, some of the ways that community has responded, and finally, this particular guide that's meant to support the 2013 guidelines. In terms of the way that communities have responded, next slide, please. There are four particular ways that I will highlight. One, and the bigger one, was a community consultation that was organized by GNP Plus, the Global Network of People Living with HIV, and the International AIDS Alliance, as well as some focus group discussions that were organized by ICW and GNP Plus. And in terms of broadly, also there was engagement from the interagency task team, as well as the community engagement working group. And next slide, please. For the community, the big survey that GNP Plus and the Alliance organized, this was an online e-survey using SurveyMonkey, and it explored key preferences in relation to what ART to provide and when for different populations. The questions were developed based on the topics that the WHO had investigated through the PICO questions. And these were expanded upon, obviously, to cover particular issues for communities. And over 1,000 people responded on the e-survey. And the more qualitative e-forum discussion involved at least 150 people. You'll see there some of the topics that were included, the clinical aspects of this, the operational as well as the programmatic, sort of following the lines that the guidelines take. The second sort of community voice, next slide please, were some qualitative studies that were conducted in Malawi and Uganda. These were specifically looking at understanding women's perspectives on option B plus. So in total, eight focus group discussions were held, four in each country, and with a total number of 88 people. I think the key thing that came out of the these discussions is that women, the recommendation that women be provided the option to take up lifelong treatment during pregnancy was supported across the board. Next slide, please. I suppose a key message from all the consultations, and I can imagine from the IATT also, is that ARVs alone do not save lives. So people living with HIV need universal support to quality care and support as well. In terms of the responses to the finished product, I will borrow some of the points made by Sheba of the Asia Pacific Network at the IAS, which was in general to support the raising of the thresholds that people be offered treatment at CD4 500 and below. But I think a key point that Sheba made is that all of this is well and good, but in most settings, countries are not able to meet the resources even at CD4 350. Therefore, the country conditions really matter. The resources available at country level really matter in how all of this translates into making the quality of life of people living with HIV better. And also, I suppose, in terms of interpretation, I think Godfried mentioned the really importance of the whole continuum of care. And I think it's important to say how all of that is translated at country level is very important. And I suppose it's a way of also explaining why a community guide that speaks to these points is important. Other concerns, I think Godfried alluded to them, and these were raised also at the IAS, was around the recommendations made for children, like children under five and access to care. So it's around the inconsistent supply. I suppose this is true across the board, that, you know, it's well and good to start people on treatment, but what are the implications of you know, stopping and starting where there are stockouts and things like that. And lack of access to food, to water, and all the other things that really make ARVs effective. All of those need to be factored into. And generally, the preparedness of the health systems in all of these sessions, how easy it is for these guidelines to be put in practice. And I suppose the general support for people, this is their family networks and all the people that are important to make sure that people can actually adhere to these ARITs for them to be effective. So moving on, those were some of the general comments and responses that have come. I'm sure there are a lot more that others may possibly comment on at the end of the discussion. I will move on now to actually the community guide that GMP Plus, the Alliance, and Stop Rape Now are producing at the moment. Actually, the rationale for this comes a lot from the e-consultations and the community discussions that were had around this guideline. And I suppose it also speaks to the component, the guidance that has come from WHO itself, you know, in terms of the programmatic guidance given and its emphasis on task shifting and all of that, on really the importance of community being involved. So some of the points that I'll run through these next points very quickly, Mitchell. So some of the points that came out from the civil society e-survey was the importance of human rights, and really that the importance of human rights and also secondly, like the importance of involving people living with HIV in the research, the planning, the implementation, basically all of these stages of the rolling out of ARTs. And also the importance of ensuring that the behavioral and other structural interventions are in place. I think it's agreed by everybody. It's not enough to provide people with ARVs. You need to provide them with support, with either, you know, if it's behavioral support that helps them to adhere to treatment and so on and so forth. And generally addressing the social, legal, and other issues that may impede them from properly accessing ART and have an impact on its efficacy. And I suppose really key, and this speaks to Stockhouse and all of us, was ensuring that there's a long-term view to all of this, to assure access to the drugs, not only to the drugs actually, but also to the diagnostic tools. I think Gottfried highlighted the recommendation that viral load now is, you know, will be a key tool in the monitoring process. But I think the response that came from most civil society is that in their countries, there are very few viral load machines, so a lot of people will not have access to viral load tests at a frequency that's meaningful. And therefore, the clinical monitoring and ensuring that there are good communication links between people living with HIV and their health practitioner becomes really, really paramount. And lastly, I think the last point is really that in task shifting, ensuring that the community involved is supported. And I suppose, consensus that there needs to be there needs to be links, you know, from the district, the national, the district, the local, in all of the programming. So I suppose these points, all of these points, so make sure you will do a big jump. You just run through those very quickly to slide number 18, I suppose, number 19. I think all of the last points actually speak to the need for a community guide and really why GNP Plus, the Alliance, and Stop AIDS Now have come together to really almost, to fill a gap. The guidelines that WHO done are great and they're speaking to a particular community, and now just bringing it a step down to the community, so it's actually to support country partners in translating these recommendations, I suppose. And the objective for the next slide, please, Mitchell. Yeah. So it's to help the country partners to really understand. Understand the guidelines, and I suppose to help them in that process of translation that Gottfried talked about, like really bringing it to their own setting and all of what that entails. And I suppose preparing them also for the different roles that the community will have to play, you know, there will be decentralizing. I mean, these are things that are already happening, but actually strengthening those the task shifting and the roles that communities have to play. And I suppose, importantly, to help them demonstrate the added value for community to health outcomes. I suppose this demonstration is important if communities will get the support that they need to actually further strengthen those systems that are managed by the community. So the GMP Plus, SOPAID Now and the Alliance already have some key modules and themes that these have already been identified in the different processes. However, they're seeking input. They're seeking most input in prioritizing the topics and also, seeking some guidance on what format would be useful, the format that this guide will be put in. So I suppose for everyone on the call, there's a website there that you can go to find out more information. At the end of this presentation, I'll also give Amy, who's at GMP Plus, her contact, her email address, where you can send those comments and any input that you have. A final thought, I suppose, to all of this is really to put people living with HIV, women, children, everyone, their rights and their choices at the center of all the decisions that are made, I think, concerning their health and their family's health, and also, like, really involving communities at all the different stages and supporting communities to be involved. So thank you all. And as I said, Amy is also on this call, so I will do a Gottfried and say all the difficult questions will be answered by Amy. So thank you.
Great. Mona, thank you so much. That was terrific. And also these slides and the contact details for the follow-up and the survey will be posted on all the group's websites so people can engage in that really important conversation. A lot of terrific questions coming in, and I want to get to those and also open the lines. And let me start. Dr. Mbengashe, I'm not sure if you're on the line, but Tomile Mbengashe is the Chief Director for HIV at the South African Department of Health, who I think is on the line. Are you there? And you can hit *7 to unmute if you are. All right, I know we were having trouble getting through. As Gottfried said, a number of committees and groups were set up, and Joachim Pillay, the Deputy Director General for Health in South Africa, and Dr. Mbengashe were both very involved, and hopefully we'll get to them in just a moment. In the meantime, really great questions coming in. Again, avac@avac.org if you want to email them, or you can post them on the web. And we also can take questions live, and people can hit *7 to unmute. I would ask that you introduce yourself, be brief, and then *6 to go back on mute so that we can keep the line nice and clear. But let me start, Gottfried. A number of questions have come in terms of the practicality of the guidelines. And I know this was a question that came up quite a lot at the IAS meeting in Kuala Lumpur. Given that many countries are currently failing to enroll at the 2010 guidelines, I wonder if you can just provide a perspective in terms of the practicality. Is this just wishful thinking? And doesn't this just, as you put in one of the slides, increase the gap of numbers of people in need of treatment? And how do you and those who worked on the guidelines respond to that criticism that this doesn't really change things?
Yes, practicality. I think we have to be quite realistic in acknowledging that some countries have come a long way, and some countries have actually reached with the 350 threshold fairly high coverage levels, and specifically some of the countries in southern and eastern Africa. Not all of them, but some of them have really made tremendous progress. So the question is, where would these countries go from here? And obviously, that's the discussion that's taken place now, and how could these countries, and I think really this is where this longer-term vision coming in, how can ARVs be used more strategically to really not only keep people healthy and alive, but really also maximize the prevention benefit. And I think that's the conversation that countries need to have, and that's exactly the processes that we as WHO would like to help facilitate to say, well, what would be the next somewhat ambitious step to take, and what would it take to actually get there. And clearly we need to be very, and that's what we are putting also in the guidelines, we need to really have countries think through some of their needs for strengthening some of the aspects of the health system, like supply, procurement and supply chain management systems, availability of diagnostics, etc. And obviously looking at some of the barriers for some of the people, the social, legal barriers in other countries to access services. So what we are trying to achieve with these guidelines is to find a middle ground, obviously based on evidence, and push the envelope, and to really move forward. And you have been saying, Munu has been saying, the diagnostics issue and the viral load availability. Several countries will say, well, we don't have it yet. But I think the response here is, that's well understood, and you need to work with what you have now. But at the same time, countries should be encouraged to really put into their next proposals for the Global Fund or in those programs that are now more and more nationally funded, really move to the next level and step up to making viral load available. For example, I was in India, and I was really surprised to see how viral load capacity is still limited, and we made a very strong pitch to the highest level in India, really to say, well, viral load is really important if you want to improve the outcomes, but also improve the quality of the care that you're providing and you know, recognize treatment failure early. So it's a short answer is, yes, the guidelines are putting the bar somewhat higher, but at the same time, we would like to have countries think very much through the implications, what it takes. Although we have strong advocacy with the donors to really embrace the new guidelines and also make the investments available for you know viral load, for greater eligibility, et cetera, et cetera.
That's terrific, Gottfried, and really appreciate that perspective about kind of finding the ground between aspiration and feasibility as well. One question came in, and I'm actually going to put the slide back up, from someone who asked about the impact or potential impact of this change. And it was a slide that you'd gone through, and I wonder if you might just give a little bit of background in terms of how these calculations were made, and are there some key assumptions that people should be aware of in seeing these guidelines, in seeing these estimated impacts?
The key assumption that's been made is that the shift from the 2010 to the 2013 guidelines towards full implementation would be over a five-year period, and that would give us by 2025 those additional gains. So it's not assuming that every country is now immediately fully implementing the 2013 guidelines. It factors in that it will take for countries a few years, and we factored in 5 years, to actually make the policy changes and then sort of gear up implementation to move towards, by 2018 or 19, I think it was, towards full implementation of the guidelines, so that we could by 2025 see the full additional benefit.
Terrific. So just to be clear, this is, again, within a practical estimate in the sense this doesn't assume everybody adopts them the day after Kuala Lumpur. So it is a reasonable set of assumptions there then from your perspective.
Yes.
Great. Very, very helpful. And again, these slides and links to, as you see in the slide, this comes from the WHO Global Report, and we'll make those links available. I know that somewhere online, I think Lee has a question. If you want to hit *7, you can go ahead and ask it. Lee? All right, we'll come back to that in a moment. Lee, if you do get off, it's *7 to unmute. And maybe I'll pause there, too. Anyone else want to ask a question live of Munu or Gottfried? And hit *7 and please introduce yourself. All right, well, while we are waiting, any questions from the line? A couple have come in related to prevention, and as you pointed out, Gottfried, this was the first consolidated guideline and very much with a treatment focus. But I wonder, some questions here about the role of PrEP, of pre-exposure prophylaxis. How are they handled in the guidelines, and what is the way forward in terms of the added prevention benefit of PrEP in addition to what you've described here with treatment?
The consolidated guidelines include recommendations made in 2012 on PrEP, and we have reviewed in 2012 the studies that have come out at that time that speak to PrEP, and we are recognizing obviously the value, the potential value of PrEP on a larger scale, but at that point are recommending that countries find out the best ways of actually delivering PrEP through what we refer to demonstration projects. And we are actually working with a number of countries at this point to really see, well, if PrEP is an intervention of proven efficacy, how can we actually practically deliver it in the field and then basically turn it into something that is an intervention of high effectiveness. So we are recommending PrEP, but as a first step for countries to move forward with PrEP in those populations that are serodiscordant couples and sex workers, we are proposing, and MSM, we are proposing demonstration projects, small-scale projects before countries go to large-scale implementation. So the next step is we are, as I said, working with countries to see how the countries could do that. We will review the evidence, the implementation experiences, and might make a new recommendation in due course for fuller implementation of PrEP.
Great. Thanks, Gabriel. For people who are interested, there is a list of all the various demonstration projects, both some of the ones that Gottfried alluded to and others. If you go to avac.org/prep, you can go down the page and you'll see there's a link to a listing of all of those that describes the locations and the populations. An additional question came in from an advocate in Uganda that wasn't specific to PrEP, but saying, given the evolving nature of information and that this being the first ever comprehensive consolidated guideline, what is the plan for subsequent updates as new information, whether about treatment or PrEP or anything else comes up? How is WHO planning to address that?
Thanks very much for this question. I think it's a really important one. We are trying, and we have been discussing this with a broad range of stakeholders in a couple of meetings about a year ago, where countries, specifically country implementers, have asked us to increase the, I would say, predictability of new guidelines. So that, you know, WHO is not pulling every now and then a new guideline out of the hat. And we have committed to have a full revision of our guidelines every other year. In other words, we will have 2015 full guidelines, and we will have every 6 months updates on the guidelines. If there's something new that came up in whatever areas, we will have a short update on saying, well, now we are talking about self-testing. We have just we don't have a strong recommendation on self-testing in there, but if that comes up between now and December, in January you will have an update. Next year in July you will have an update, and then again in January 2015, and then by mid 2015 you will have the next full version. If there are some breaking news or some breaking studies, WHO will obviously be responsive, and we want to keep this as dynamic as possible. So if there's really something, a new major study that comes out that says, hey, you know, this is the thing to do, we will go as quickly as possible through our rapid advice process to review the evidence, and if needed, come up with a rapid advice at any given moment in between now and 2015.
Great. Now, that is incredibly helpful. Related to that, a question I know that came up a bit at IAS and someone asked here as well, in terms of the updates that would be new information about that, will there also be updates as you go in terms of the uptake of the guidance? I know a lot of conversations about, translating global guidance from WHO at the country level. Do you envision that in those 6 monthly or annual reviews, you might be able to say, X number of countries have adjusted or adapted the guidelines to kind of keep a sense of how it's translating at the country level?
This is Meg Doherty, and thank you for giving me an opportunity. I just want to mention that on our first guideline dissemination meetings, what we have done is we're taking, we have a baseline survey of all the policies that are in place right now, what the plan is that the countries have for the next 6 months to year, and we will go back and do that survey again and be in communication with all countries to see what they've been able to implement, what needs to be put onto a two-year time frame or a different kind of time frame. So we definitely will have that information at both 6 and 12 months.
Oh, terrific. Thank you so much, Megan. Thanks for being on the line along with Gottfried. I know that you've done so much of the work alongside and really appreciate that. A question actually for both of you and for Munu. Both Gottfried and Munu, this actually comes from Lee Hertel, who wasn't able to, I guess, get off mute, but sent the question. Both of you mentioned the issue of task shifting, and particularly Munu about community involvement in task shifting. And Lee's wondering, who and how will this work? Are there some specific ways that you all might be thinking in terms of how that might be accomplished? Who might get trained? What kinds of standards might there be for community outreach workers?
Where do you want to say that? Sorry.
Okay, I'll leave it open to any of you, Munu, Gottfried, or...
Yes, Gottfried here. So in terms of the task shifting, we basically have recommendations to move towards sort of a broader team approach in delivering services. And specifically in situations and in countries that have very doctor-driven models, to move towards given sort of other medical personnel, nurses and others, and the community a much broader role. And we specify also what types of aspects of the service provision could be done by the various levels. We recognize that task shifting is the implementation of the task shifting recommendation is going to be highly context specific. In a country that has as many nurses as it has doctors, let's say India, maybe that is something that is not going to be implemented in the same way as it is in a country that has very few doctors in some African countries, for example. Even though we do have some generic recommendations on how the task shifting could play out in different situations, you will see that in the guidelines, we recognize this is certainly an area that needs to be discussed, but we want to make the point that it is being discussed, and certainly we do see, and that's also what's specified in the guidelines, that community-based agents, community health workers, would have a strong role both in supporting those who are taking antiretroviral treatment over years, in terms of retention support, in terms of adherence, etc. So we specify that, but I think it's going to be highly context specific.
Great, thanks. And actually, related to that, an additional question came in about national regional differences. As you go forward with guidelines, do you envision regional differences in, coming up with regional guidelines that are or epidemiology specific guidelines, or do you foresee that for the long term it will be global and those kinds of national regional variations will come out in the implementation, not in the guidelines?
What we are actually seeing now is already in these original workshops that we had, like the one in South Africa and the one in Indonesia, the conversation is quite different already. I mean, there's the clinical aspects, but obviously the major conversations that take place, and it's the question that you have also been asking, how are we going to implement that, and what does it mean in different types of epidemics, in different sort of situations where how sort of health development, etc. So we do not recommend, and that's what we have discussed with our regional offices, we do not recommend that now over the next year we have six versions of regional recommendations and six versions of regional guidelines, and then the following year the countries adapt it. We do not recommend that. We do recommend that countries themselves or groups of countries with possibly similar characteristics might want to look at the guidelines and might want to share some of the implementation approaches, some of the implementation challenges and solutions that prevail in their given setting. But in the interest of time and not wasting, you know, in the next year and now having regional sets of guidelines, we want to move right to the next level, and that's to the country level.
Great. Incredibly helpful. Oh, sorry.
Mitchell,
go ahead.
Can I just come in just to add to, I think, to give a specific example to the earlier question in terms of how task shifting and what that means for communities. Yeah, I'll just give a specific example. GNP Plus and StopAIDS Now are working on a program called Mark's Art in Swaziland. And I think what's coming out there is how, like, community is really involved in all the different aspects of the continuum at testing stage, that the community is really involved. They're what is called in that context expert clients. And they're involved not only in the counseling aspect of it, but actually in doing some of the tests and also at treatment stage. I think that with really taking some initiatives to improve adherence is actually taking the delivery of ART to the communities. And, communities are involved in that, the expert clients and other aspects of community. And like Gottfried said, I think in the care and support, they're providing the treatment literacy, the advocacy, the adherence support, and all other aspects that support the efficacy of treatment, I suppose.
Great. Thanks, Mino. Very, very helpful. I wonder, we're drawing to the top of the hour, I realize, but I just wonder if Dr. Mbengashi from South Africa is on. *7 to unmute, talking about country-level thoughts. Dr. Mbengashi? All right. I do know, for those interested, I know the IAS website from the Kuala Lumpur meeting does include a number of slide sets and webcasts. And Yogan Pillay, the Deputy Director General for Health in South Africa, who was very involved in the operational guideline aspect of the consolidated guidelines that Gottfried presented, did a really superb job, and I know he and Dr. Mbengashi have been working on kind of the South African perspective, so I certainly encourage people to look at those slides going forward. One additional question, and I wonder, Gottfried, that just had come in, and that I wonder if you might want to address. Muna had mentioned it really as one of the first points from the community consultations was the issue of kind of the rights-based approach as thinking about the guidelines and the implementation of those guidelines. And I wonder, as you've had and beginning to have the regional and national consultations, you know, WHO certainly has done a really important job of engaging with civil society, as you both described in your presentations. How do you see that playing out at the national and regional level, and any thoughts on recommendations to those advocates on the line in terms of how they might engage and at the country level to best effect?
Well, as you said, the whole equity issue, but also the human rights aspects are very, I believe, are strongly highlighted in the guidelines. The question is, as it is other areas, but maybe even so more so with this area, what's going to happen with it? So, all I can say is we collectively at WHO will do our piece, but also really that's where your role is so important. We need to argue and very strongly for the involvement of again, a broad range of, stakeholders, they call it, that include human rights activists that are around the table when decisions are being made, and that really can also put sort of the broader enabling environment sort of into the discussion in saying, well, what are some of the social barriers? What are some of the legal barriers that we know prevail in many of these countries? So I do think the policy discussion that is now happening in many of the countries around, when to start 350, 500 is important, but it is really the opportunity to talk about the broader implications in terms of health system strengthening, but also in terms of the broader barriers that as we know, in many countries continue to exist. So all this to say, we need to really ensure that, first of all, these people are around the table, and we need to push from all angles so that they are. And then we need to have the conversation that needs to happen, not narrowly focus on some of the technical aspects, but really on the system aspect, system capacities that needs to be strengthened, the resources that need to be available, in many cases internally, so that these arguments need to be made, but also, as we said, the social and structural barriers that we know continue to exist. So we see these as opportunities, and we need to work together that it actually happens.
Great, Godfrey. Thank you so much. I know I've gone a little bit over time. I wonder, Muno, do you have any last thoughts? And as you collect your last thoughts, and I'll turn to you, Godfrey, I will put back up your last slide in terms of the way people can engage with the survey and Amy's email address. But any other closing thoughts from you, Muno?
Actually, something I should have mentioned, that the aim is for the guide to be available at ICASA in December. So any comments that people would like to give, please do so as soon as possible. I'm sure Amy would have wanted me to say that. And maybe give an opportunity to Amy to say anything more.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead, Amy.
Great. Thanks, Mitch, everyone at AVAC. For this opportunity, I think very well, and so really the main thing for everyone who is on this call is to please fill out that community guide survey that will help us to prioritize what topics to cover and how to deliver it to you.
Great, thanks. And we will circulate again to all the people on the line and those many who registered who weren't able to join or only for part to be sure that people can engage in that. And Megan Godfrey, perhaps I'll turn to you just in closing. Any last thoughts and charges to this group to really move from guidelines to implementation and impact?
I started, I'm sure Meg has some, will add something. One of the things that I would like to put forward again is the guidelines are probably more ambitious than some of the previous guidelines. And again, it is, as you said, we have to strike the balance between aspiration and feasibility. But sometimes concerns about feasibility hamper progress. So I do think we shouldn't get too hung up that not everything is in place. We need to obviously look at sort of major gaps, et cetera, but I do think we should and would like to encourage us all to use the guidelines as a strong tool to advocate for broader access, to advocate for addressing some of those issues that need to be addressed, but ultimately to move forward when it comes to people, as I said, keeping people healthy alive, but also really as looking as and to ARVs as an important intervention and a tool for prevention. We also need to recognize that all countries will move at the same speed, and not all countries on Monday morning will now rush to switch to the new guidelines. From the WHO side, and I would really also hope from the community and advocate angle, we need to continue to push that these conversations happen. They need to be done in a rational way, but we also need to recognize that countries may make different decisions at different points. And some countries, for example, are now deciding, even those that came to the workshops that we're organizing, they are moving towards a test and treat approach for key populations, even so we don't at this point recommend this in the guideline. So we need to recognize diversity. We also need to recognize sovereignty in countries making their own decisions, but we need to do the best that we can in pushing the envelope and informing the discussion as much as possible. Nick?
Yeah, my comments would come from just our recent experiences in South Africa rolling out to 13 countries and discussing this with 13 countries. The most I can say is that countries have already had these internal dialogues. I think they're continuing to have this. They've already have a very good idea of where they're headed. And also in all of these meetings, we're trying to make sure, and so are the countries, that civil society are always represented at these meetings and that they continue to be part of the dialogue as the national programs look to modify their guidelines. And as Kenley said at the last meeting, it's really important that the governments talk to civil society because they can tell them exactly what's happening in terms of the gaps, the stockouts, the this, the that, and then they can be incredibly helpful in making the program a success or hampering a program from getting to where they want to go. So we're continuing to state that as we move forward in all these meetings. So my encouragement to GMP Plus, the Alliance, Stop AIDS Now, is to keep these dialogues going and make sure that representatives are at the table during the discussions in the national programs.
Great. Meg, thank you so much. I think it's so important to have leadership at WHO, both you and Godfrey, describing that. Certainly civil society will continue to push always in so many ways, and it's great to have you pushing in that same direction. I really want to thank both of you at WHO and all that you represent in terms of the people who've been involved in the guidelines, as well as Muna and Amy from GNP Plus, colleagues at the Alliance and at Stop AIDS Now, in helping put on the webinar, but more importantly, I think we all hope that these can become platforms for ongoing conversations, so that this is not just the launch of a guideline over the last month or so, but to find mechanisms so that civil society has a voice at the table, so the WHO can feed back to this group how the conversations are going at country and regional level, and how do we make sure that these don't stop as a Kuala Lumpur 2013 document, but rather really set the stage for ongoing guidance, implementation, updating, as Godfrey described. And yes, it's aspirational, but it's a starting point, and we hope an important starting point as we all rally to make sure that it moves off the page and into practice. I can just say from an AVAC perspective, in trying to find that balance between aspiration and practicality, and knowing that 9.6 million people were on antiretrovirals before June 30th when the guidelines were launched, and the number didn't change because the guidelines were published. Guidelines don't change health systems. It's what we all choose to do with those guidelines, and certainly we're struck by some of the similarities with what was described as aspirational in the 3x5 initiative almost a decade ago, which people said wasn't possible. And in fact, it did not reach the target, but it really set the stage, I think, for collective action to move the field forward. And hopefully what's happened over the last year in developing those guidelines, the work that civil society brings to the table, working with and pushing partners at the country level and working and pushing partners in Geneva will get us into the right place. So I want to thank everybody here. Please do be sure to fill out the community guide survey. It's a terrific opportunity to engage in this process. And again, thank you, Gottfried and Meg, and we look forward to ongoing conversations amongst all of our communities and organizations to really move this all forward.
Thank you. Thank you, Mitch. Thanks. Thanks for the
job. Have great afternoons, evenings, mornings if you're still having them. Thanks again.
Thank you. Thanks.
Thanks.